hot party. The trippers, the grasshoppers, the hip ones, all gathered in secrecy and flying high as a kite.
Hello and welcome to Trippin' Through Time. I am Stuart.
And I'm Randall.
And this week we are going to continue our conversation from last week where we're talking about opiates.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to get into some heroin.
And
talking about heroin, sorry.
So we're going to start off with our weekly segment.
Mm-hmm.
Is this true?
What are we drinking?
Yeah. Well, so I was telling Randall, I was going to save it for the podcast. This is a Pono Brewing.
Mm-hmm.
And now this is interesting because Pono Brewing doesn't have any brewery equipment. They just go around to other breweries in Portland and borrow their stuff.
Now, that kind of makes sense when I think about restaurants do that.
Mm-hmm.
But like with a brewery especially, I feel like the tank itself is going to color the beer.
It could, but they clean the tank.
Okay.
Yeah, I think they might have their own fermenters because that does take a long time. But I don't even think so.
Interesting. That's pretty cool.
They brew at Zeugel House.
Zeugel House,
which is a brewery here in Portland, German.
Okay.
Brewery.
Well, that's nice of them.
That is very nice.
What? Why? Why would you? I mean, besides the kindness of your heart, is there often equipment you don't use?
Maybe.
Or do you just pay them?
I bet they pay them.
Okay.
And. They made this one like a year ago that I really, really liked.
Get her little paw, hold it.
Oh.
Oh. Claire. Claire's got a baseball and she's holding it like a human.
It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Anyway, and they had one that I really liked, but their beer's only been on tap. So today was the first time I saw it in this weirdly tall can.
Yeah, it looks like a full 20-ouncer there. Or it's a proper English pint, if you will.
It's an English pint, 19.2 ounces.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So I'm very excited to try it.
Isolation hazy IPA.
Oh, yeah. Isolation hazy IPA. And there's two people standing six feet apart.
Oh, it's very low.
Yeah, 5.
And only 6 IBUs. I might like it. Or 61.
I think it's 61. 61. IBUs, yeah. Give it a shot.
The color's really nice. It's orange. Oh. Uh-oh. You don't like it?
That's good. I don't like to give any impression before you have a sip. I don't want to taint your opinion.
Oh. It's good, but it's very much an IPA.
Mm-hmm. It's not super... Yeah. Some hazies have that really nice, fruity, juicy characteristic.
This I get some more... piney, citrusy notes, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's just IPA all the way.
Nice and smooth mouthfeel.
Yeah, it's good texture, for sure.
Mouthfeel. That's nice. I'd give it a 6.8 out of 10.
Okay.
We're doing reviews.
Decimals.
We're doing numbers now.
We're doing reviews. So I have something a little interesting today. I'm trying to, you know, like, I have a weak stomach, so I'm trying to get stuff. So I'm doing...
You're trying to get stuff?
I'm trying to get stuff situated.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so I thought maybe some probiotics would work, so I'm drinking a lot of kombucha. And I was like, but Randall, I like to also drink.
Mm-hmm.
So why not combine the two?
Whoa.
Yeah. So we're doing a Kyla Hard Kombucha Lavender Lemonade with a hint of lemon and lavender, which it's kind of redundant, but I would think lavender lemonade.
Now, is this kombucha with, like, alcohol added to it?
I mean, I think it has to, right? We can figure it out, probably.
Because I used to make kombucha, and I don't know how you'd get it to be that alcoholic. 6.5%.
I mean, they probably finish it with something, I would imagine, but maybe not. Hmm. I don't see anything here.
Maybe there's just some way to, like, you put more sugar in it. And
maybe.
More alcohol or something.
It's not very many carbs in here. 7.
Hmm.
But, yeah, so I've never had any hard kombucha, and it's pretty hard. 6.5.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
It's cool a beautiful purple color. He's drinking it out of a champagne flute, like a bougie little bitch.
I'm very fancy. Ooh.
Oh, wow. That's so good.
Yeah. It tastes, guys, like a pink lemonade.
Yeah, it does.
And then it's got just a little bit of funk at the end.
Yeah, it's really nice. That's really good.
You know, we were just speaking of High Wheel.
We were.
This is very reminiscent of it.
There used to be a place in Portland called High Wheel Fizzy Wine, and they made these fizzy wines.
Mm-hmm. It was mead finished with champagne.
Mm-hmm. And it was delicious.
Yeah.
Light, fruity. This is a lot like that.
I used to drink that instead. This is close.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if they were getting run out and we just didn't know about hard kombucha.
Maybe.
But
I've had hard kombucha. It wasn't this good.
Oh, okay.
This is a good one.
Yeah, it's really nice lemon.
Mm-hmm. I like that a lot.
Refreshing. I'd get that again.
Yeah, that's good.
Hmm. Well.
All right, shall we?
I don't know how to rate this because it's not a cider, mm-hmm. so.
What would you rate it as just a beverage?
As a good beverage, I would say it's in the 8.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, nice.
That's good.
I agree. Okay. So last week, we left off talking about artists. Is that mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah. So we're kind of getting into the Victorian period mm-hmm. era of people expressing art through drugs.
Right.
Or drugs through art.
Right. So believe it or not, not only the artists took opiates, and they weren't the only ones addicted to them. It was very widespread throughout all levels of society.
No way.
Yes way.
Maybe because it was super addictive?
Maybe.
Oh.
And I think right now we're kind of focusing on the use in the UK.
Okay, yeah.
So in the 19th
you
century...
You wrote it, Stuart.
19th century, they kind of started to see the addiction becoming a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Before, they were kind of turning a blind eye to it or didn't really see addiction as an issue.
A slight tangent, I guess, is just that... you have to remember, so like the American pharmaceutical industry is a force to reckon with now, mm-hmm. but it didn't used to be that way. And mainly it was Germany and Sweden, Switzerland had all those pharmacies,
right?
You know, the pharmaceutical companies. So they would always get the new drugs first.
I see.
And it took a while to get to America. Mm. So a lot of the problems always originated in Europe.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
So in 1868, the United Kingdom passed a law that restricted opiate prescriptions to trained doctors.
Sounds like a good idea.
However, the law did not cover things in which opiates were a main ingredient.
Oh.
So you could still sell like chocolate with 99% morphine in there.
Well, I guess that's one thing.
And one example of this that I liked was Dr. Collis Brown's Chlorodyne.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a mixture... It was a tincture, an alcoholic tincture of opium and cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
And then another...
It was used to treat cholera.
Used to treat cholera? Mm-hmm. Do you get diarrhea on cholera?
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a good...
Yeah, because as we know, we've already kind of talked about that opioids are... what's the word I'm looking for? Constipatory?
I don't know.
Cause constipation.
Anti-diuretic?
Yeah, maybe.
I just made that up. Don't quote it.
Huh?
There's another one, Miss Winslow's Soothing Syrup.
That sounds so nice.
And this was targeted to young children that were having coughs, right?
Right.
And what was in there exactly?
I'm pretty sure it was morphine.
Yeah. So morphine for children if they had a cough.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah, morphine in a delicious syrup.
I bet it made your kids so much
they'd
better.
They'd be asleep.
Wow.
Yeah. Miss Winslow was really... Really good.
And now what do we have?
Yeah. I mean, the best we have is diphenhydramine, right?
Yeah. I saw something the other day. It was, I think I saw an ad for it somewhere. It was melatonin targeted for kids. Hmm. I just thought that was strange.
Yeah, if you have a sleeping problem as a kid, it's not good.
And they made it look all fun, like kids and like rainbow
gummies,
letters.
Melatonin,
and then
gummies.
Each one was like a different fun little color.
Oh, my. I don't know about that.
I don't like that. I don't think kids should be taking melatonin.
So, no, they shouldn't.
So, yeah, 1868, they passed that law, so clearly they saw it becoming a problem, but people were getting around that. So another interesting thing in the 1800s that was going on was the American Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And the American Civil War was unprecedented in a lot of ways, but in terms of the weaponry used, the scale of injuries,
mm-hmm.
this is one of the biggest wars to ever happen,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, with semi-modern, you know, they had artillery and that kind of stuff. Gatling guns.
Wasn't this like the first time, like, it's like people were going around with horses and like bayonets and all of a sudden other people had like Gatling guns?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And there are some really gruesome injuries that went on, like a lot of limb amputations.
Yeah, amputation was like the thing.
Yeah. And at the time, they were not, the level of medicine wasn't even close to being able to deal with all these injuries. Like, they didn't mm-hmm. know how to deal with an amputation and make sure that there was no infection.
Mm-hmm. Didn't have antibiotics.
No antibiotics. Yeah. So infection was huge. I'm pretty sure more people died of disease than died in combat. And so they didn't really have anything good to treat these horrible wounds they were seeing, and so they turned to morphine.
I spilled.
Uh-oh. That's okay.
I'll get something.
Hang on. We'll pause.
Sorry.
So they turned to morphine to treat these horrible wounds. Mm-hmm. I wrote panacea because that's a word I recently learned.
Ooh, yeah, I like that word. It was a panacea of infection.
Exactly. Morphine was a bit of...
catch-all.
Yeah, cure-all.
Yeah.
And Civil War doctors just gave it around, gave it to people like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
There was one Union doctor named Nathan Mayer. And he would ride around these camps on his horse to diagnose people from horseback.
I'm sorry. She just, like, aggressively grabbed it and then, like, threw it up in the air. It's so cute.
We're going to need to put her in a different room when we record. It's too distracting for Randall.
So cute. Sorry, guys.
Now she's just staring at it. Dr. Nathan Mayer would ride around these Union camps mm-hmm. on his horse and diagnose people from horseback. Like, you're sick. Your arm is gone.
From horseback. Mm-hmm. Well, the arm God make. I think I could do that from horseback. And then missing an arm, sir.
Then if he decided they needed morphine, he would pour it into his hand and have them lick it off his hand.
Oh, what a power move. You Isn't want some that... morphine, bitch?
Lick it. Isn't that crazy?
Like a horse.
He's up on a horse making people lick his hand.
There you go. You want some more?
Oh, that's so strange.
That is strange.
Yeah. So opium use among soldiers in, and this is both Union and Confederate soldiers mm-hmm. were taking it. Opium,
drugs don't discriminate.
Heck no. Opium use among soldiers in the Civil War spread a lot. It was used, like we said, as a panacea. It was also used as an anti-diarrheal and pain reliever, obviously. Mm-hmm. And
did you think that was gonna fall over?
No, I heard a weird sound.
Oh, okay. Sorry guys, things are happening around us.
And so obviously a lot of soldiers became addicted, and this was known as soldier's disease. So people don't really know the level because no one was studying it at the time, but it's estimated that around 400,000 soldiers by the end of the war were left with an opium addiction, morphine addiction.
Yeah.
And
it's so sad. I mean, they fought for their country, right?
Yeah.
I guess causes aside.
Right. Most of them were conscripted.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Drafted, mm-hmm. basically?
Drafted.
Yeah. You basically need morphine because your arm is gone.
Right.
But then all of a sudden, it's highly addictive. You come back and now you have a crippling addiction.
Right. And it's kind of the same thing with when we were talking about the Germans.
Yeah.
They were just given this, and they didn't know, and all of a sudden you're taking crazy hard drugs. Like, remember mm-hmm. the people in the submarines that took that mix of all kinds of
and
stuff?
And they basically surrendered when they got out. They're like, I'm so fucked up right now.
So veterans that had an addiction, the way they treated it is they would have a leather bag that they wore around their neck.
No.
And it had a supply of morphine sulfate tablets and a hypodermic needle.
Oh, my God.
And once they ran out, they were done. That's all they got.
Why you gotta put it on your neck?
I don't know.
Like, why just wear a backpack?
And then
a backpack?
Put it in your pocket?
Yeah, why do you gotta put it in?
I don't know.
Just like sip it through a straw or something?
Yeah, I don't know.
Wow.
The term soldier's disease wasn't recognized until 1915, which is long after the Civil War. And this is when morphine in the public eye became seen as a negative thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when people realized, well, all these Civil War soldiers were addicted to this bad drug.
I mean, you see a similar parallel from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about that. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was just talking about like PTSD and shell shock.
Mm.
And as far as like everybody was coming back and it was like, oh, they have shell shock.
Yeah, right.
And finally people were like, oh, this is like an actual thing.
Right.
PTSD, you know.
Yeah. In World War One, they call it concussion something because
mm-hmm.
they thought it was the concussions from the artillery was messing with your brain because people were all palsied and all kinds of horrible things. Mm. So now we're going to move to the next. Well, we're going to skip World War One, but during World War Two, they invented something called the Sarette. Do you know what that is?
No, I don't.
A Sarette was a morphine package, and it was designed to only have the appropriate dose. And you'd stick it in someone's leg.
Ooh,
usually.
Wow, that was scary.
I just stuck his leg.
Yeah.
You'd stick it in their leg, and it would automatically administer one dose of morphine.
Okay. I
and
wonder if it's like capillary action.
Something like that, yeah. I think they said it had a little block thing, and once you stuck in their leg, that would break.
Oh, okay.
And then the morphine would drip in. And this was designed to prevent overdoses.
That's
And they would pin these Sarettes to your lapel if you got one so that people treating could see, oh, he's already had two. Something like that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's pretty smart.
Yeah. And that show Band of Brothers I was telling you about.
Yeah.
It's about World War II. It's probably dramatized. Dramatized? Dramatized?
Dramatized.
They know what we mean.
Dramatized?
That doesn't sound right. Overly dramatic.
Dramatization. I don't know.
It's overly dramatic, but the medics would, like, if you got shot in the leg, they'd give you the Surette, and then they'd, like, wipe their finger in your wound and write with blood on your forehead.
Oh.
And that's how they knew they
like
had.
Like, one?
Yeah, he had one. Mm. And then if people are like, oh, he's not going to make it, they just stick him with, like, 10 of them.
Oh.
Just for the heck of it.
I'd be like, excuse me, doctor, seems like you've used too many, and then I pass out.
Not a bad way to go. And I really couldn't find anything about World War II soldiers with opiate addictions. So perhaps this Surette system worked.
Or maybe they were just so high on amphetamines.
Maybe. Or maybe I'm not very good at researching. Who knows?
That's probably the likely culprit.
Next, we're going to talk about Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And in Vietnam, heroin's very cheap.
Okay.
And as you know, Vietnam really sucked butt.
Yeah.
So a lot
that's
of
what I heard. My grandpa said, you know, son. Oh, I don't know why I said son. You know, grandson. You really sucked butt.
I've heard the same.
Yeah.
And so a lot of military, U.S. military personnel stationed in Vietnam tried heroin during their tour. It's actually estimated that half the military personnel stationed in Vietnam tried heroin.
Wow.
And there's a lot of people stationed there. So that's a lot of people trying heroin.
That is.
And they say about 1/5 came back with a heroin addiction.
Oh, my goodness.
And like I said, it's because heroin is super cheap, and it helped to alleviate these horrible conditions these soldiers were in.
Yeah.
One of the, in my opinion, that's with like World War I, that's probably some of the worst war conditions I can think of.
Yeah.
The army and the government was afraid that these soldiers were going to come back and spread the use of opium throughout the U.S., and or heroin specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And and also because heroin was so much more expensive in the United States, they were worried that these veterans were going to blow all their money on this addiction.
That's what they're worried about.
I guess so. So they introduced something called Operation Golden Flow.
Oh, what?
And Operation Golden Flow, it's just clicking with me, is they did a urine test with every American.
That's why it's called Golden Flow.
Yeah. They did a urine test with every soldier returning from Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and if they tested positive for opiates, they had to stay in Vietnam and detox and try again a couple weeks later.
God, that's awful. You'd want to get off, probably. Yeah, right? You don't want to be in Vietnam.
And an interesting thing is Vietnam veterans were very good at beating heroin addiction, statistically.
Mm-hmm.
So they said that of the people coming back, that the fifth coming back that had a heroin addiction,
mm-hmm.
only 5% relapsed within the year,
mm-hmm.
and only 12% had a minor relapse within 3 years, which is very low for heroin addicts.
Now, this doesn't surprise me. Do you know why?
No.
Okay, so this is a very common thing, and I think people don't take into account as much as they should. When you said that, it reminded me, when we talked about this in our drug and behavior class, it is crazy low, and it's so low that there's got to be an explanation for it. So people tried to explain it, and basically,
Can I do mine first?
Oh, you have an explanation
of the time, and then you can say if you think this is accurate. Yeah. So at the time, they said it was because of the disruption of environment. So they said these soldiers became addicted in this horrible environment of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they came back to the United States, it was such a disruption of environment, they just didn't need it anymore.
That's pretty much it. Yeah, it's like a condition place preference.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of addicts, they associate stuff, the environment, with your drug use. And
right.
So if you change the environment dramatically,
right.
you're not as inclined to use the drug. It goes hand in hand.
And going from a war zone in Vietnam to mm-hmm. like the suburbs of Atlanta is probably the biggest change of environment I can think
Huge.
Of. Yeah.
And that, on a little side note, most opioid overdoses are not because of a dose increase. It's actually because they took it in a new circumstance.
Right.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we're going to talk a little bit about opiates in today's military. So, believe it or not, opium and opiates are a big problem today, but for a different reason. According to the National Institute of Drug Abuse, the percent of veterans in the VHA system receiving opiates... I don't know what VHA is.
Yeah.
That's what it said. Veterans Health Administration, I think.
I guess so. I mean, VA.
That's what they said. I'll call it VA.
Okay.
Anyway, is old data, but from 2001 to 2009, the percent receiving prescribed opiates increased from 17 to 24%.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
24% of the people in the VA are getting prescribed opiates.
I believe it.
The opioid overdose rate for veterans was 21% in 2016.
Wow.
Which is up from 14% in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of hard to find more recent data, but it's pretty easy to say that a lot of veterans are being now prescribed mm-hmm. opiates by their doctors for, mm-hmm. for pain, and it's becoming a big problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what we'll get into, I'm sure, in later episodes is, like, the heroin problem didn't go away. It just changed into a pill.
Right.
That's about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. yeah. And then most people that... I don't know most, but a lot of people that are using heroin started out
mm-hmm.
with their doctor prescribing them something legally.
I got my wisdom teeth taken out. They told me, take two of these a day
mm-hmm.
for 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
How many pills is that?
8.
How many did they give me?
30.
Yeah.
Yeah, same.
Why?
I don't know. So I got the same thing, yeah.
You can fill... I've been prescribed benzodiazepines.
Mm-hmm.
You can give like 3 at a time.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to give 30.
I had the same thing. Yeah.
And I don't understand it.
Me
Why
either.
Give an abundance of opioids?
Yeah.
It's just crazy to me.
It's
irresponsible of the doctor, honestly.
It's very much, yeah. And they are cracking down. I just read a story of some doctor on the East Coast who was just prescribing people opiates mm-hmm. and they would pay him and he mm-hmm. got arrested.
There was a huge, I was looking at Purdue Pharma or something, is required. They the people that own the opioids know how much money's going in and out, how much they're selling to a doctor.
Right.
So they're like required reporters to the DEA.
Right.
And they decided not to report somebody for like 10 years.
Oh, wow.
Because they were making tons of money. Jeez. He was prescribing, I think the like it worked out to like... 100 prescriptions a day.
Jesus.
For like an absurd amount, you know?
Wow.
You can't even see 100 patients a day.
Yeah. Wow.
So like, yeah.
I was reading this thing about Johnny Cash, and he mm-hmm. was real addicted to drugs. And he had a private doctor. And I think his doctor wrote him at one time like a prescription for 1,000 pills.
Oh my God.
I think they were opiate pills.
Yeah.
Valium or not Valium.
It was probably like Oxy,
that's the
hydrocodone.
Word. Yeah, within like a month. It was something crazy like that. Or maybe wow. that was Elvis. I don't know. One of these stars.
I mean, but... everybody seems to have a personal doctor. Michael
yeah.
Jackson.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
Well,
Prince did.
Prince. And they all die of like drug overdoses
yeah.
from their doctor prescribing it.
Yeah.
I don't really understand. Some things blow my mind because it doesn't change. Because
yeah.
it's so blatantly obvious.
Well, does your private doctor ever prescribe you
a little too much? I don't have a private doctor.
What?
Yeah, I know.
Oh. Well. And the last thing I want to say is now, according to the VA website, they are introducing more non-opiate pain relievers. But I did hear that they're trying fentanyl.
Fentanyl. Yeah.
Which I don't... They claim it's less addictive, but I don't know.
It's less addictive. It has such a low therapeutic window that it's incredibly easy to die.
Right. But I guess if you're being in a professional setting,
yeah.
maybe it's
safer. A lot of times they'll put it in a patch.
Right.
And it's just interesting, and we'll get into this in the chemistry corner, which mm-hmm. I'm very excited about, because opioids is a very fascinating mm-hmm. one. But there isn't an alternative way to treat pain, and that's what's driving chemists crazy.
Mm.
You can't separate pleasure from the lack of pain.
That is interesting.
They can't do it. They don't know how.
Yeah.
They can't. They've done so many chemical rifts and they still can't figure it out.
Yeah.
And it goes to reason that maybe it's not possible.
Well, I don't want to sound like some hippie, but I do think that cannabis can be
mm-hmm.
beneficial in treating people's pain
yeah.
in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hang on, I want to pause for a second.
Sure. All right, so Stuart kind of caught you up on the rest of the history there, as far as like morphine. Now we're gonna dip into the history of heroin and some other synthetic derivatives. So let's get going. You ready? So from morphine to heroin. So soon scientists wanted to improve on morphine. The holy grail right now is there a way to make an effective drug for pain that's not addictive? Can we make a drug that alleviates pain, mm-hmm. but it also doesn't create euphoria? Surely we can. We'll talk about it later. But in 1874, Charles Alder Wright prepared esters of morphine and codeine, including acetylcholine, and mono and diacetylmorphine. Diacetylmorphine sound familiar? It will. So next, our old good friends at Merck in Germany produced ethylmorphine, which proved to be a very similar to codeine in both structure and function. And Merck marketed this as a cough suppressant in 1898. Okay.
Why does it work so well as a cough suppressant, these opiates?
You know, I have to think that my best guess, which we probably should get into in Chemistry Corner later, mm-hmm. refer to it, and hopefully I'm right, but it's the same thing with, I was talking about cannabinoid receptors being, you know, distributed throughout your body. It's the same thing with opioid receptors. So there's opioid receptors in your brain, but there's also a lot in your lungs.
I see.
And so opium depresses that.
Okay.
And so there's certain receptors probably that attach to your lungs. Mm. But I'm not positive.
Okay. Buy that for a nickel.
Yeah, I would too. So next, we have Merck marketed this as a cough suppressant, yep. Making it the first semi-synthetic derivative of morphine to hit the market. I know, it's just adorable. It's the most adorable thing.
She just pushed her little ball away and then pawed it back.
I know, she's playing and it's adorable.
We'll post a picture of her.
Yeah, can we post a picture of her on the Instagram?
Yeah, check out our Instagram. I'll take a picture for playing with the ball right now.
Yeah. We'll do a photo shoot with Clara.
Hey, Clara.
Look at her. She's eyeing you, but you can't see it. All right. In 1897, so just a year earlier, diacetylmorphine was rediscovered by Bayer. You know Bayer, right?
Yes.
Bayer aspirin.
Makes aspirin.
Right? Heinrich Dresser at Bayer tested diacetylmorphine on rabbits and showed that it slowed and deepened respiration. Okay. Mm. Okay, so maybe it's similar to morphine, right?
Maybe.
So Dresser tested it. Tested as a cough suppressant and found it to be highly effective, especially in people with tuberculosis.
Hmm.
So coughing.
Tuberculosis affects the lungs.
Yes.
For some reason, I always thought it was your spine. I think because...
Yeah, you're getting confused.
Because, what's his face? President.
Roosevelt?
Roosevelt had it, right? And that's why he couldn't walk.
I mean, maybe. I don't know.
I think it is. So I always thought, like, oh, tuberculosis, no, now I can't walk.
It's definitely a long thing.
Because then I've seen pictures of people in the iron lung.
Yeah. Yeah.
That have it.
So as legend goes, Dresser also tested a large dose on himself and his colleagues. And they found that it made them feel strong.
No way.
Or heroic, even.
From this, what does it mean to feel heroic?
Oh, well, if you take heroin, you might know what it feels like. So from this, Bayer derived a new name for the drug. Diacetylmorphine.
No way.
Yes.
That's where the name comes from? Because it makes you feel like a hero?
Yes.
I'll be shitted on. That's crazy.
Right?
Wow.
So they took it, the people that, it was like, ooh, it makes you feel heroic.
Yeah.
Heroin.
I never knew that. That's very interesting.
There you go.
Wow.
Etymology is one of my favorite things.
That's crazy.
There you go. Or as the legend goes.
It's interesting, though, because heroin means a female hero.
Yes, yes.
So maybe it had a feminine characteristic.
I don't know. Maybe. So the biological activity, we're getting into the biological activity now, okay? Is dependent on two hydroxy groups, okay? It's on position 3 of the A ring and 6 on the C ring. Morphine itself has 5 rings. It's a pentacyclic ring, What are you doing?
I'm posting to our
Instagram. Do that later. It's distracting. I have to do it now. Okay. So it's got two OH groups, one on the three on the A ring, six on the C ring. If you substitute these, okay, it's cute, but we can get a better picture of her. Oh, that's adorable. That's good. It's a little blurry.
It's a little blurry.
Yeah. We'll do better. But that's cute.
Yeah. We got two pictures now.
Okay, you're back with me?
I'm back with you.
Okay.
That was important.
What?
That was important.
I know. So on position three, the A ring and the C ring not being substituted, okay? If you substitute the A3 with the ester instead of an OH, what do you get? Codeine. Okay? Modification of both groups essentially makes a non-bioactive molecule, as in thebaine. Do you remember talking about thebaine?
Yeah.
Okay. But heroin substitutes both of these OH groups and acetylates them. So why does heroin work? We just said if you substitute one group, you get codeine, less active than morphine. Substitute two groups, these two hydroxy groups, you get thebaine, and it's not biologically active. Heroin substitutes two of the same groups, mm-hmm. just acetyl.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't it not be active? Well, turns out that our brain is really good at deacetylating things. And so it can take that acetyl group off. And so basically, you can think of heroin as a prodrug for morphine. All your brain feels is morphine.
Mm-hmm.
Heroin is no different to it. You can think of it's very easy for it to pass the blood-brain barrier. That's why heroin can get in there much faster than morphine. So it's express delivery. Our friend Richard Miller, a quote that I like is, so basically, heroin is an intercontinental ballistic missile system for rapidly delivering morphine to the central nervous system. So basically, if you acetylate morphine, it makes it so it's highly deliverable, goes right into your brain, and then your brain takes out those acetyl groups, and you got pure morphine.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, wow.
It's good stuff.
Wow.
So in 1898, Bayer put heroin on the market as a cough suppressant.
Mm.
And unlike morphine and codeine.
Wait, Bayer did? Yeah. Merck did.
No, Bayer.
Oh. What did Merck put on the market as a cough suppressant?
Semi-synthetic ethyl morphine.
In what year?
1898.
Same year.
Yeah. Mm. So they're competing. Yeah. Heroin on the market as a cough suppressant, and they marketed, unlike morphine and codeine, it was not addictive.
How would you take this heroin? Can you take it orally?
A lot of it was orally. Yeah, you can take it orally.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you can. It's really good getting into the brain.
Right.
So that same year, it was introduced into the United States because Bayer's a European company.
Can you take eye drops to take drugs? Any drugs?
I mean, I've heard about.
Can anything be absorbed acid. To your eyes?
I've heard about people taking acid in their eyes.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, like it's a membrane that can absorb. I mean, anything that can be absorbed through your butt or nose probably can be absorbed through your eye.
Hmm. Okay. Continue.
I mean, that's my best guess. That's wise world words from Randall. Anything through your button nose goes right through your eye.
Hmm.
I would think.
Okay.
So unlike in New York, this guy, Morris Menges, Manges, M-A-N-G-E-S.
Manges.
Manges. He reported it was 100 times safer than codeine.
Wow.
So the way heroin, part of the problem was the way heroin was used masked its true nature. So people would take it for either acute respiratory problems, mm-hmm. which means you wouldn't take it that long.
Mm-hmm.
And when your respiratory infection's gone, you just stop taking it. And you didn't take it long enough to develop a tolerance or to develop addiction. Or you took it chronically, as in a TB patient,
mm-hmm.
and you take it till you die. So you never withdrew from it.
Yeah.
Doesn't have bad properties if you never withdraw.
Right.
But it was soon apparent that heroin was highly addictive. as we've seen with all other
right
morphine derivatives.
Yep.
So in New York and oh, this is my fun little thing. In New York and elsewhere, heroin addicts needed money. This is just a fun tangent. In order to fuel their drug habit. So they started finding and reselling valuable pieces of junk.
Mm-hmm. Valuable pieces of junk.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I see on the street people throw stuff away. I'm like, I could use that.
True. Yeah, okay.
One man's trash is another man's treasure.
True.
So they started buying to fuel their drug habit. What do you think you'd call them?
Junkies.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
That's the term junkies came from.
Oh, heroin junkies. Yeah. Yeah.
Because they would literally buy and resell junk to fuel their drug habit.
Wow. Not that much different than today's heroin junkies.
Yeah.
You don't really hear of like a crack junkie. It's always junkies a heroin junkie.
Yeah, junkies very specific to heroin for some reason.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Cool. I like that.
Yeah. Mm. It's etymology today. Mm-hmm. Anyways. That's kind of the story of heroin.
Okay.
Just came in, is another failed attempt at trying to make something that was... It's really funny because they were like, hey, this morphine's good at pain reduction, but it's too euphoric. Let's try and make something else. And they accidentally made something more euphoric. Mm-hmm. but now we're going to go kind of through some other semi-synthetic...
How long opioids. Was it legal for?
Oh, I don't know. It's a good question. It's a good question.
I feel like not long. If it was introduced in 1898... I feel like in the early 1900s, they started cracking down on that kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, I think by the second decade of the 20th century. So that's what you just said, early 1900s. Mm-hmm. They were cracking down and knowing that heroin was highly addictive.
So there were 20 sweet, sweet years in there.
20 sweet years of thinking that heroin was safe to give your child.
God. Wow.
It's crazy to me.
I wonder what kind of stuff we're doing now that... 100 years, we'll look back and say, what the hell? That's crazy.
I often think cancer treatment will be one of those.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Whoa, they're like killing every cell in your body just to kill one cell?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Hmm.
Yeah. But I would like to know, like, I don't know. We're going to be like, turns out eating bacon is like, made you 20 IQ points more stupid. And we have like no idea.
Why I'm so stupid.
Yeah, I eat so much bacon.
I do eat a lot of bacon.
You do. You want a bacon fetish or something.
Yeah.
Put a grease on
it. Yeah. I got that cast iron skillet. It makes such good bacon.
Cast iron makes a lot of good stuff.
Way better than a normal skillet.
And that bacon. Peppered salt and pepper bacon.
Sea salt and pepper.
They make
and garlic.
Fred Meyer's.
Yeah. It's a good.
Is that good, girl? anyways, we're talking about semi-synthetic opiates.
Yeah, yep.
Okay.
Such as bacon.
Addictive potential as good as bacon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So as with heroin, chemists were still trying to search for that holy grail. Something that would, you know, be a pain medication that worked but was non-addictive. Certainly this should be possible, right?
Right.
I mean, we did it with cocaine.
All right.
We have cocaine derivatives like benzocaine, lidocaine, procaine. They're all effective analgesics and local anesthetics, but they don't cause euphoria like cocaine.
Hmm.
And they have similar chemical structure. We just took out the addictive properties. Mm-hmm. Surely we can do it with heroin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We can do it with morphine. Well, we'll see. We can't. I spoiled it. Spoiled it. So the chemical structure of morphine, which we're kind of talking this about, because this is... In order to do chemical riffs on things, you have to know what the chemical looks like. So the chemical structure of morphine was found by Goulard and Robinson in 1925. I want that to sink in a little bit. And this is very common with a lot of medications. People were using it, prescribing it, and it was widespread. And they need to know what it did or looked like or acted on the body.
I thought last week we said it wasn't until like 1952 that they found the morphine.
I bet it was them
synthesizing it.
Yeah, synthesizing it. Yeah. You can determine a structure without being able to make it.
Right.
Yep. So 1925, they found what's the structure of morphine. It's pentacyclic, like I said. And so this allowed chemists to start looking at what different little things can we change about this molecule to change it.
Mm-hmm.
To maybe make it not addictive. So, manipulation of the morphine encoding on the C ring. Remember, there's five rings. So, if you just change the C ring, just name them. There's a certain way, but ABCDE, right? Five. Yeah. Brings about hydromorphone, hydrocodone, oxycodone, oxymorphone. Okay? So you get all those from just manipulating the C-ring.
When I got my wisdom teeth, they gave me hydrocodone.
Yeah. Instead of oxy?
Yeah.
Apparently mine were impacted.
What's that mean?
It means that they're so deep they had to drill in the bone. And so they were like, that's more painful. So they gave me oxycodone.
Is oxycodone more powerful than hydrocodone?
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah. And mine was also mixed with, I think, 500 milligrams of acetaminophen.
Right. So that's no longer hydrocodone. That's hydrocotton.
Hydrocotton. Yeah. That sounds right.
Or hydrocotton. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oxycotton, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's because when it's mixed with that, they usually call it that. It's right. Vicodin or other stuff.
That's what Vicodin is?
Yeah. It's hydrocodone mixed with acetaminophen, I believe.
So if you have a Vicodin addiction, mm-hmm. that's got to be bad for your liver.
Terrible.
Like House MD had a Vicodin addiction.
Oh, you should just... He's stupid. He should just take hydrocodone.
Wow.
If he's not addicted to the acetaminophen. He's just killing his liver at that point. And he has access to it. He's a doctor.
It's probably just because Vicodin, people know the name.
I know.
So, it's I love Vicodin.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. It doesn't sound as sexy. I love hydrocodone.
Yeah, I guess so. Although it does sound crazy. Like, hydrocodone sounds like a crazy name.
Yeah.
Anyways, what happens if you manipulate by bridging the carbon 6 and 14 of the C-ring?
Mm.
Well... Oh, and you bridge it using a bimethylene chain, of course.
Duh.
But this brings about atorphine, a drug thousands of times more potent than morphine. Do you know what atorphine is used for?
No, never heard of it. To shoot me? Oh, it's a
large game tranquilizer.
Oh.
It'll stop a rhino in its tracks.
Really?
Yes. Oh. Elephants down.
Wow. It doesn't kill them, though.
No. This is a... Just takes them down.
Okay. Yeah.
They're in a coma, basically.
Wow.
So, super potent, right? It's like the number one thing. Like a tranquilizer dart? Yeah, it's a atorphine in it. What's in it? So, taking... what happens if you take away the oxygen bridge? Maybe the entire molecule as morphine is... It's pretty complex.
Would atorphine be fun to do? Like,
no,
recreationally?
No. Mm. Probably not. You'd have to be right in the sweet spot before... Probably not.
I see.
Yeah. I think it's kind of like fentanyl. Fentanyl is really dangerous, but it's not super feel good.
Right.
But it will kill you.
Right.
And it's very strong, stronger than morphine.
Right. So.
If you take away the oxygen bridge, you get what's called morphinans. So it's a riff. You know, there's so many when you take away that they made a different class. They're still very potent opioids. Just like morphine. For example, levofenol. Very potent. It's very similar to morphine. It's enantiomer, so just a mirror image of it. It's a familiar name. Dextromethorphan.
Hmm.
Ring a bell?
Yeah.
That's your sleep medicine.
Yeah.
That's your Benadryl.
Right.
Sorry, Benadryl's diphenhydramine. But dextromethorphan is like your cough suppressant, right. Stuff in NyQuil, your sleeping medicine.
What's DXM?
I think that's dextromethorphan as well.
Is it?
Yeah.
Because people take that to like trip out.
Yeah, robo-tripping?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Take enough of it, starts acting as a hallucinogen, which is interesting. But that's a common name, which is interesting. So think about it. The right hand, dextro, it's common over-the-counter. Mm-hmm. Left hand, potent. Opioid. It would be like morphine. Just a simple mirror image of each other. It's crazy.
Can I tell a quick story?
Of course.
When I was in...
I'm almost done, so like we better tell a lot of stories.
Oh, we're at a good time.
What time is
45
it?
45 minutes.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, okay.
When I was in high school, I wasn't doing anything, but there was this kid. We were like out.
Sure.
And there's this kid standing on by the street on the curb.
Mm-hmm.
And we were crossing the street, and he wouldn't cross the street. And I thought that was so weird. And I turned to this other kid. I'm like, why won't he cross? And he was just, like, staring down off the curb.
Oh, my.
I'm like, what's up with him? They're like, oh, he's robo-tripping.
He's robo-tripping.
And I guess he was really scared to step off the curb because to him it looked like it was like 600 feet. Damn. He's like, I'm going to step off this cliff.
Oh, my God.
And I never wanted to do it after that because it didn't look fun at all. He was like, he was terrified to step off a curb. That's not fun.
There's a lot of things that people do because they're desperate.
Yeah.
And that's one of them. Another one is taking nutmeg.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that'll make you trip. Who takes salvia? Yeah. And then what else? Huffing sealants and glue.
Paint, glue. Yeah.
Nitrous. Yeah. It's all terrible highs.
Yeah.
But people are desperate.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's a slight tangent. I don't have a point. Like, I don't have an argument for this. I don't have a right answer. But it is interesting to bring up the question. Those things are highly toxic and highly dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
If drugs were decriminalized and not as big of an issue, would it force people to go down these roads that take things that are highly toxic?
Yeah. I was watching Steve-O from Jackass.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a YouTube channel now. And he was talking, he's done pretty much every drug you can think of.
I'm sure.
And he said for him, the most addictive was Whippets.
That's crazy.
Yeah. He said that's the thing that really got him hooked.
Wow.
Like more than cocaine, more than any of that.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Just a little whipped cream.
And he'd hallucinate people. Like he'd record himself all the time. Mm-hmm. So he recorded himself taking this Whippet. And then he was saying he was watching a line of people come in to his apartment, and they sat him down and gave him an intervention.
Oh, wow.
His hallucinations gave him an intervention.
That's amazing. That's your brain like, dude, we need to stop. Can we make it a hallucination? That's amazing.
Yeah, he didn't, though.
Oh, really? Oh. He's done now, though, right?
I think he's clean for like 10 plus years.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it really is.
Oh. Does she never go to the bathroom?
She might. She just did a fart.
And she's sitting over there.
Yeah. I'll take her out when you leave.
Okay. When I leave? Oh, I'm leaving all of a sudden?
Oh, when we go out.
Oh, okay. Anyways, let's keep on doing these chemical riffs, Stuart.
Yes.
So using the 4-phenylpiperidine moiety, do you know what a moiety is?
Nope.
It's a very pharmacological term that people talk about. And it's basically like a certain sub-part of the structure that has a function.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of people will mention the blah, blah, blah moiety, and it's responsible for pain. The blah, blah, blah moiety, it's responsible for the hallucinogenic effect. That kind of stuff.
I see.
Or you can, like, classify drugs by it. Like, oh, these drugs look crazy, but one thing that's similar is this, and you call it the blah, blah, blah moiety.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyways, this one had the 4-phenylpiperidine ring moiety, and it gave pethidine, also known as Demerol. Heard of that? It's a huge clinic thing they used to give it. You hear about people's movie stars' Demerol addictions?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I only know it because watching The Simpsons, so I'm not going to be high horse here. It's not, I actually know things. I just know parodies of things. And then that also yields methadone, which you heard of methadone clinics?
Yeah.
Demerol was like before methadone.
Okay.
This is similar. And then another highly related compound, fentanyl.
No.
That's what you, when you get that. And then all fentanyl.
Hmm.
All fentanyl, sorry.
Hmm.
And I don't know what that is. This is very similar to fentanyl, but I would be curious like how it differs.
Hmm.
And guess what happens when you make N-allyl derivatives? You change change it to an N-allyl derivative, you get antagonists.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with antagonists versus agonists?
You've talked about it, I think, but I don't remember.
So just a quick review. An agonist binds to the receptor and produces an effect.
Hmm.
And usually we say that effect is like the positive effect, right? Like
okay.
a hallucination, a feeling of highness, you know, euphoria. Right. The opposite, an antagonist, still binds the receptor, but it either produces no effect or the opposite effect.
Hmm. Okay.
So usually it binds but doesn't produce anything.
Okay.
So these have come in really handy. Something that binds to the opioid receptor, so morphine doesn't bind, But doesn't do anything. You know what that could be used really well for? Mm. Preventing overdoses.
Mm.
So this is where you get naloxone, naltrexone, and naloxone.
Mm-hmm.
So oxymorphone turns into naloxone if you just change it to an NL. And add a methyl cyclopropyl group, and you get naltrexone.
Mm.
So this is the Narcan. This is the potent opioid antagonists that allow it to stop an overdose in its tracks.
Mm.
It'll force you into remission, and you're going through withdrawal after you take it.
Mm.
Opioid withdrawal within seconds.
Oh, wow.
They're wow. very potent antagonists.
Wow.
And then entorphine, do you remember that? That's the elephant tranquilizer. Mm. You put an NLO on that, guess what you get? Buprenorphine. Have you heard of that?
Mm-mm.
No. I was so excited when I heard. Buprenorphine is very similar to methadone. They give it for people mm. withdrawing.
Okay.
They've also found some, I think, I might be getting it confused, but some antidepressant effects as well.
What's the thing that people carry around in case you're getting a...
Narcan.
That's Narcan?
Yeah. Oh. Naloxone or naltrexone.
Okay.
They're all agonists or partial... Or they're all partial agonists or full antagonists of the mu opioid receptor, which we'll get into. But it basically prevents an overdose.
I see.
Every emergency responder and cop should have it. But unfortunately, they do not. What are we going to do now?
I don't know. Clara, back up. Other way. I will pause.
I got it.
Got it?
Yeah. Oh, man. What's going on?
God, rough day today.
Yeah, I don't know. That's all I got.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah. We should probably finish it off, though.
Yeah.
So let's unpause it.
We never paused it.
Okay, well, so thanks for listening. We kind of finished off the opioid history, got into heroin, got into morphine, talking about it, that is. And we kind of got into the chemical synthetic riffs of it. And this is where you get all the new drugs that the pharmaceuticals mm-hmm. that you always hear about,
mm-hmm.
hydrocodone, oxycodone, where you get fentanyl that we're having this big crisis. And the chemical riffs on morphine it's an abundant molecule to riff off of.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's pretty interesting that we got all these things from a simple poppy.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, and nature's always showed us the way, which is interesting. Yeah. That's the most hippie thing I've ever said.
Nature will show us the way, man.
Yeah, man. But it's true. And so our next episode will be the final in our opioid mini-series. I guess that's what I'm calling it now.
Mm-hmm. Episode 4 of the mini-series.
Yes, this is the last one mm-hmm. of the mini-series. So episode 11, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, because this is 13. Mm-hmm. So episode 14, next episode, will be kind of diving into the opioid receptors. What are they? What's the chemistry behind them? How do they bind?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we separate pain from pleasure?
Mm.
So that'll be kind of what we'll do. And then we'll go on to another drug
yeah.
in case you guys are getting tired of this.
That's good.
Yeah. Okay. So check us out on Instagram and Twitter.
Oh, yeah. I posted two pictures of mm-hmm. Clara.
Yeah. We'll post some more because she's so cute.
It's
Trippin' Time Pod.
Yep.
TRIPPIN Time Pod.
Yep.
And that's both Instagram and Twitter. We're now up to 2 followers. One of them is your girlfriend. so if we could
get on Twitter?
Yeah.
Nice.
But to be fair, we haven't posted much.
We have one follower on Instagram.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's me.
Oh. Okay.
My other account. Yeah.
So I'm hoping we can get some more people and
yeah.
So yeah. Hope you're enjoying the podcast still.
Yeah.
And we'll see you next time.
Yeah. Catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
Adios.